Dr. Michael Roizen.
Dr. Michael Roizen.
You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show.
You're listening to You, the Owner's Manual Radio Podcast on Radio MD, iHeart, or where you really should get most of your health podcasts, podcasthealth.com. Thank you very much for downloading us. I'm your host, Dr. Mike Roizen, coming to you from the Cleveland Clinic. And we have a wonderful guest today. You may know her because she's a famous person for her writings at the New York Times. But today we're going to talk about a book she's authored called The Elusive Body, Patients, Doctors, and the Diagnosis Crisis. It's a book published by Penguin. The easiest way to find out more about it, go to Amazon, of course, or your local bookstore, or you can go to her name, Alexandra Sifferlin, Sifferlin.com, no punctuation, to find out more. We are brought to you, as usual, by our two sponsors, long-term sponsors, more than 5 years for both. TruBiotics, Bovine Colostrum, and DiRescue are made by LifesFirstNaturals.com, or at least found out there. Go to that website, LifesFirstNaturals.com, to see the randomized double-blind trials involving those, as well as our own website, ForYoungevity.com, ForYoungevity.com, where you can sign up for the free newsletter. But most importantly, let's get to Alexandra. Alexandra, why did you write the book? What was the motivation?
Sure. So as a health journalist, I would frequently hear from readers who would write to me, and often these were very desperate emails, asking if, as someone who interviews a lot of doctors, if I knew someone who might help them with an undiagnosed condition that they had been living with, you know, often for weeks or months or even years. And it would happen with enough frequency that I really became interested in this question of why does the diagnosis sometimes go wrong? Why do some people experience really prolonged periods of time without a diagnosis? I also had people in my personal life who had also experienced very long periods of trying to get a diagnosis for their health conditions. The book is dedicated to my sister, who would fall into that group. And I just got to see firsthand how much anguish living without an accurate diagnosis can cause.
And sometimes the diagnosis, even when it's done by biopsy and pathology, isn't correct, which is why we always say on this show, if you're going to do something for more than 3 days, you should get a second opinion. How easy are second opinions to get in general, and does that help on diagnoses accuracy?
I think that's excellent advice, especially when people are having or experiencing something that doesn't seem to be easily resolving. It's because you want to have, ideally, people coming from different perspectives, being able to look at the same health issues and symptoms that you're presenting with, and ideally coming up with their own diagnosis. It's great to get a second opinion, as you recommend. I think one of the issues is that actually getting that second opinion can be very complicated by the sheer way of how the health system feels like it's structured right now, whereby it can be very difficult to get an appointment with your own primary care doctor, much less someone you haven't seen before. When I was doing interviews for this book, so many people mentioned some of the same frustrations. It's hard to see a doctor. It took months to get an appointment. And then when I got an appointment, the appointment itself felt really rushed. And many of the physicians that I interviewed complained about the same things. So again, I think getting a second opinion is great advice. I think the issue is that doing so can sometimes feel more complicated than perhaps it should be.
Yeah, I don't know if other places have it as easily as our Cleveland Clinic does, and I obviously am biased by this, but there is just a place on the website where you can easily click and for a non-personal second opinion, meaning if you just want them to look at lab data and a brief history that is sent and the lab records and medical records from other places, I think it's pretty easy to get it within 72 hours. But that may be, that's not with a an actual physician appointment, that may take a little longer. The other component that we actually got motivated to do this, way back in the early 2000s, Johns Hopkins pathologists looked at the diagnosis of breast cancer from other institutions, not their own, and found a 30% error rate. I don't know if that has gotten repeated in the recent past, but I think it's that high an error rate means that for serious, obviously serious diagnosis, one should always get a second opinion. How common, what we see a lot and what I see a lot of, and you deal with this in the excellent, obviously you're a great writer, but the excellent book, The Elusive Body, is pain and fatigue as things that lead to no diagnosis for a long period of time, or what you might call uncharacteristic or unhelpful diagnoses.
Yes. So one thing I found through my reporting was a particular patient group that often ran into struggles here were those who had symptoms like the ones that you just specified, things like fatigue or pain, or I might put something like brain fog in there, where it's a lot of excruciating symptoms and they feel very unwell, but sometimes those symptoms are not presenting with clear signs of disease. So, you know, a patient goes into a doctor, says, I'm feeling very fatigued. I don't feel like myself. I have a lot of brain fog, but they don't have anything that's, you know, immediately coming up on a diagnostic test. They don't have a simple rash that the doctor can look at and assess. And I think in those cases, it can be a little bit more complicated. A lot of the physicians I interviewed said, you know, fatigue is a symptom for so many things. And it can be quite difficult when you fall into that category where there's not a whole lot outside of symptoms for the doctor to assess and navigate.
One of the interesting things is we've gotten a lot more what you would call blood tests recently that help predict things, such as we get the test of myeloperoxidase, which looks at 5-year risk of cancer and heart disease or stroke. We get the risk of, if you will, some of the MRIs that show something. From a physician's standpoint, it's very tough to know how to pursue those. And I imagine from a patient's standpoint, it's even much tougher. In the book, you do deal with some of that.
Yes, I spoke to some doctors who were talking about some of these newer kinds of tests that look at different biomarkers or things like you mentioned that could be really helpful in these situations. The sense I got, and I'm curious for your thoughts, is that these aren't necessarily, many physicians may just not be aware of them yet. They're relatively newer, or at least their deployment hasn't been super widespread. And so especially in a situation where perhaps, you know, so many people are going to urgent care or emergency rooms for care because, you know, many people don't have primary care doctors. And that kind of testing isn't something that a physician might bring up right away. That might be different at Cleveland Clinic and in sort of your experience.
Yeah, obviously the patient, I practice in the privileged enough environment that we get an hour with new patients and 30 minutes with returns, so we can go through an awful lot with them. But that's a privileged environment. One of the things you do deal with is vaccines and the uncertainty created by the MAHA movement. You should know from the point of full disclosure, Dr. Oz, Mehmet Oz, and I, in writing one of our earlier books, interviewed everyone on the childhood vaccine spectrum, from Dr. Tinpenny to the most of the vaccine developers. And afterward, no one would talk to us. Obviously, what we wrote in the chapter, and Oprah, we did a full show on Oprah with it, and then did PSAs for the CDC more than anyone, although they got stopped in 2015. But the data is that the childhood vaccine combinations have a 40,000-to-1 benefit to risk ratio. That is, there is risk, and the vaccine skeptics have made the vaccines much safer since 1990. But there is risk, but it is clearly outweighed in a 40,000 to 1 ratio. That clearly the vaccine schedule can be modified, but the reason it's the way it is to make it easiest for the patient, the family member, that is the mother or father and the child, to get them. But it has no science behind it, if you will. I think that at least most of us feel that the skepticism currently over vaccines is hurting many patients. And you go into that in the book very well.
Thank you. So the part of the book where I touch on these questions around vaccines is sort of specifically in this chapter about autism diagnoses and how people have thought that perhaps autism is connected to vaccines or something like that. I don't find that research very compelling. But basically, something that is interesting that happens with diagnoses is diagnoses change and the classifications of diseases change. And so something interesting that's happened over time is that the diagnosis of autism, it used to be that if you were diagnosed with autism, this is from an earlier version of the DSM, the psychiatry Bible that has all these diagnoses, it was very narrow. Typically, it would be someone with sort of more severe or high support needs symptoms. And over time, the autism spectrum was created. So now you have level 1, level 2, level 3. And there is this debate that I found quite interesting about whether autism diagnoses are in fact really organically increasing, or could it perhaps be related to the fact that the diagnosis for it has changed, so it now classifies a lot more people than it did in the past.
And part of what you point out so well, Alexandra, is part of that change relates to the benefits that autism diagnosis carries, meaning you get much more of the ancillary help and care with that diagnosis.
Right. So people really have gained a lot from it. You get a lot of support. And, you know, just from an individual perspective, it can help someone understand themselves or you know, people that I spoke to, it helps that they feel that it helps the people around them understand them better. But it's just interesting. And I thought a good reminder to just let readers know that sometimes diagnoses evolve over time, that this science is not always so firm, that things change as we develop knowledge and as, you know, medical experts sort of debate and think about diagnoses.
We're talking with Alexandra Sifferlin. That's Alexandra, Alexandra, Sifferlin, Sifferlin.com. That's the way to find out more about her excellent book. The book title is obviously The Elusive Body, which talks about how tough it is for some people to get diagnoses and to get confirmation of those, as well as a lot about what I would call the problem of getting firm and accurate diagnoses in some of the difficult situations. One of the things you covered, and I'm going to briefly go to your New York Times commentary, was before you were at the New York Times, you covered some of the tougher, what I would call, viral diseases such as Ebola, MERS, and Zika. What's your current thoughts on how will those start to affect us now, or will it be worse? And what do you think has happened with the change in funding of CDC?
Sure. So I think one of the things that I'm a bit concerned about was even back when I was covering those outbreaks, like the Ebola outbreak that I was covering was largely around 2014. And even back then, a common complaint among people who respond to outbreaks, whether they were at the CDC or their sort of, you know, state-based infectious disease epidemiologists, was that we really needed to have a clearer surveillance mechanism. We really needed to be very aware of where cases of dangerous or potentially novel viruses were appearing. So obviously in the United States, but you sort of want this global structure where you're aware of outbreaks and ideally you can respond early because you don't want to be in a situation where a virus is spreading undetected. Obviously, you want to respond as early as possible so fewer people are affected. So with a lot of the changes at CDC, with the changes in funding, a lot of these programs, you know, don't exist in the same way, I think one of my top concerns would just be, are we as vigilant as we should be? Do we really have a clear sense of what is spreading or what could be spreading? Because that was a concern years ago. And I'm not sure that it's getting the kind of attention and funding that it needs now. So hopefully we're not in for another pandemic soon. But, you know, viruses are gnarly.
Thank you very much for writing the book, The Elusive Body, Patients, Doctors, and the Diagnosis Crisis. It's published by Viking, a division of Penguin. You can read more about Alexandra Shiffrin's work at Alexandra, AlexandraSiffrin.com. Find out more. Of course, you can always find about the book, The Elusive Body, on Amazon. You've been listening to You, the Owner's Manual radio podcast on podcasthealth.com, iHeart, or RadioMD.com, or wherever you downloaded us from. Thank you for doing that. We, as usual, are sponsored by Life's First Naturals and ForYoungevity.com. Go to those websites to see the data and the approach to getting, staying as young as possible. We'll be back next week. This has been 1277B. We'll be back next week. We hope you are too. Thanks again.